Welcome to the Advanced Persistent Security Podcast, where we discuss the world of IT and cybersecurity. Don't be left in the dark about what's going on in the world around you. Here is your host, Joe Gray.
Welcome to another edition of the Advanced Persistent Security Podcast. I'm your host, Joe Gray. Before we get started, the thoughts and opinions expressed on this show are mine and the guests alone and do not represent those of our employers, past, present, or future. With that being said, before we get to the actual show, I just want to let you know that this is one of the lost episodes, meaning it was recorded in 2017 and it was just never published for one reason or another. I'm going back through those episodes, doing proper editing and publishing them. So stay tuned. There's a total of four of them that will be published before we resume new episodes. I hope you enjoy. Thank you. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Advanced Persistent Security Podcast. I'm your host, Joe Gray. Before we get started, the thoughts and opinions expressed on this show do not reflect my or my guests' employers, past, present, or future. Those opinions are ours and ours alone. So, this evening, we have two published authors, Tim Gallo and Alan Liska. You may know those names from O'Reilly's Skunk Book, and it's not just a skunk. I did that research today. I can't tell you the exact breed of skunk, but it is a skunk. With that being said, the book is called Ransomware: Defending Against Digital Extortion. So to provide a little background on each guest, Tim works at Symantec. He's a cybersecurity engineer. He has experience in sales engineering, product management, and over 15 years in information security. With that, he works to provide good security intelligence to his company's clients and work on a proactive security posture. Alan is FireEye alumni that works at Recorded Future. He worked for Symantec in the past, and he also does the intelligence perspective for the threat intelligence as it relates to malicious software and other cyber threats. Gentlemen, how's it going?
Going well this evening.
It's going very well.
So, fill in any blanks and tell us a little bit more about yourselves.
So, Alan, why don't you go first?
Okay. So, to answer your opening question, it's actually a striped hognosed skunk, which when Tim and I looked that up on Wikipedia, we thought was very appropriate for a ransomware book. It fits in very nicely. Just a quick about me. I've been in information security for a very long time, and I kind of backed into it. I was a network administrator, a server manager, and I became a security person when Code Red hit. And I realized that I was working in a data center that had no plans for patching the Windows servers or any of their other servers, and that we needed to put something in place very quickly. And that started me on the path to security, and I've been a fan ever since. I've been lucky enough to work on both sides, both as a defender and as a red teamer, now I get to spend my days helping people improve their security processes.
Excellent.
And I kind of came to security in a roundabout way as well. I started off actually working in power plants, doing health physics kind of stuff. Having been a part-time computer person, however, and while I was an undergrad running some of the labs at the university, security was never something we really thought about, but administration and making certain that everything was working was something that was pretty high on our list. You know, you've got to be able to get all that information from those telescopes and crunch that data. I started to see a lot of security sort of things pop up when we see accounts get compromised and that data get corrupted, and that always kind of sat in the back of my mind. It became something I played with and started to get used to, you know, get an understanding of in sort of the Unix world, and kind of let it go when I went out into the field at first. And then randomly I ended up getting involved in some security incidents at one of my previous employers, just on their primary corporate networks, and really decided that, you know, between the fact that it was a very boring job being a scientist working at a power plant, and the fact that the computers and computer security were really where my passion was and the things that I enjoyed, I decided to move into that as a career, and haven't looked back.
And I had a very similar background. I didn't work in a power plant. I navigated submarines for 7 years before I got into IT security. So obviously there's a certain level of similarity there. But, you know, from that same vein, I didn't know I was passionate about information security. I didn't know I was passionate about anything security related when I got into industry. But now that I'm in industry, I can't even recall how it feels the other way. So, you know, I definitely understand. And oddly enough, I actually enlisted in the Navy as a nuclear engineer and just failed miserably.
So you learned a lot of ADA programming?
Not at all, actually.
Oh, really?
So, no, I didn't even make it that far in nuclear engineering school. Okay. I lasted about 3 months because I had never had to study before in my life. And oddly enough, I wasn't ready to start then. So that's a school that it's specifically built in such a way that if you don't study or you have poor study skills, you will fail straight up. Because the key to being a nuclear engineer in the Navy to meet requirements from naval reactors and the Department of Energy is the continuous training program, and it requires a lot of study. So that's kind of my background. So honestly, when I moved up forward the non-nuclear section of a submarine after I finished my schooling, you know, with that regard, I dealt a little bit with computers, but not really. From the security perspective, I was basically an operator, and we had a few systems, a few commercial off-the-shelf systems that had some customized stuff going on with them that ran, you know, Windows and Red Hat. And that was really about it. If I knew in high school that I was going to take this route, I would have probably, I'm going to pull out my accent for this, I would have probably been like, computers? Nuh-uh. Only dorks work on them things. You know, now I can't even fathom how life was before I got into industry. So I definitely understand your passion, you know, and that's the thing. The people who do exceptionally well in this field are those who are passionate about it. Those who kind of see it as a career and a hobby, if you will.
Oh, yeah. My partner would definitely agree to the hobby portion of it. And I'm sure Alan's would as well. The amount of systems and virtual money we spend on virtual systems probably could be used to buy a new car.
Weekends at B-sides, submitting to conferences, writing the books, mentoring other up-and-coming InfoSec people. I'm very lucky that I have an extremely tolerant fiance, a lot of time that is spent outside of normal working hours, you know, doing this because it's what I love doing. I'm good at two things in the world, drinking wine and, securing people's systems. And they don't pay me enough to drink wine to support my security habit, but they pay me enough to do security to support my wine habit. So it works out well.
Very nice. Very nice. And I'm glad you mentioned mentoring, because honestly, I think that's one of the most important aspects of information security today. We have a lot of people that are just trying to break in, some for passionate reasons and some because they see that's where the money lies. How do you go about mentoring people? How do you find mentees, and do you have mentors?
So, yeah,
Tim,
I was going to say, so
go ahead.
As far as finding mentees, one of the things that I find that is really interesting compared to, you know, when I started, there's a lot of university programs available today that are, you know, that provide degrees or certificates or whatever in cybersecurity or information security of some kind. And Symantec has partnerships with a lot of them, whether through corporate or through the local office that I work out of. So it gives me a lot of opportunity to meet students that are, you know, in school working to working on these degrees. But I also meet a lot of folks at these conferences that are, you know, trying to break in, whether they're coming in from the IT world or this is something that they've done for fun and they're trying to figure out how they can turn that into a career. That's one great way to find mentees. As far as security mentors go, I've got a few. I mean, you know, I've got a friend up in Tri-Cities, Washington, who is who I still consider one of the best coders that I've ever met, and I, you know, constantly bounce ideas off of him. But I also, you know, at this point in my career, I'm also looking at more sort of the business mentors as well, folks that can provide me with better language to be able to effectively communicate the technology into speak that works effectively at the executive level. And I think that's one of the things that as you move beyond just being technically proficient and need to be able to turn this into, you know, a long-term career, being able to speak at the C-level and you know, putting yourself out there, whether it's, you know, like writing white papers, books, or speaking at conferences, those are all things that were sort of dished to me as things I should do to improve myself. And that in combination with, this is going to sound really cheesy, but with Toastmasters of all things, and I've ummed myself twice, so I'm keeping count, has really helped me with my speaking, as well as just putting myself out there and getting my ideas on paper.
Excellent. And, you know, I've never been to a Toastmasters meeting, but having taught for a few semesters, at academic institutions, obviously, I have those aspiring students that want to get into information security, and they ask me, hey, what class could I take to get better in security? And my response is typically something along the lines of, if you can take on an additional technical writing course, that'll be to your benefit. You can never go wrong with public speaking. English composition's not a bad idea. The list just goes on and on. And then, of course, here comes the question of what language should I learn to get into security? And I'm like, this has been said on this podcast more times than I even care to try to count, but English or the preferred language of choice at the location in which you're trying to work.
That's exactly right.
Absolutely.
So, you know, I've just now recently started speaking. You know, I've spoken at my first B-Sides officially, technically my second, because I filled in for someone at the last second at one B-Sides, and I've spoken to an IC Squared chapter. And, you know, I play it back to myself, not necessarily from Iron Geek's side, but in my head I play it back and find ways to just constantly critique myself because, you know, I think it comes across as a good talk, but I know that I have a lot to learn and a lot of growth to accomplish to be even a more effective speaker. And, you know, to sound the echo chamber to what you were talking about in terms of communicating with the C-level, realistically, you know, you should be able to, a successful information security professional should probably be capable of speaking both to the C-level and to the T-level. You need to be able to turn your tech talk on and off. You need to be able to be in the trenches talking about NATs, firewalls, ACLs, AV-SIGs, IDS-SIGs, YAR rules, and whatever in the trenches. But then you also need to be able to convey that to your C-suite and explain what those are in terms that they can understand without patronizing or alienating them. And that's the difficult part. Would you tend to agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's a... You know, it's a challenge that many in the information security community have, because often it feels like we speak a completely different language than the rest of the organization. So we talk in numbers, IP addresses, domains, you know, indicators, IR investigations, etc. But we don't really talk in business terms. So a big part of what we have to do as an industry, what I think as an industry we have to do better, is not just being able to communicate what we're trying to do in a way that's easy to understand, but also be able to express that in a business value, you know, the business value of what we're doing, so that when you talk to the C-suite, you're not saying, you know, we stopped, you know, 1,000 IP addresses from attacking us this month, because it doesn't mean anything. You know, instead being able to translate that to, you know, here are the type of attacks that were, you know, that were attempted against the network that we stopped, and here's an article that shows, you know, another organization that was victimized by this and how much it costs them. You know, put what we're doing in terms that speak monetarily, not just explain it in a way that can be understood, but also explain it in business terms.
And I couldn't agree more. I like to use a theory that I've started recently using called the butter theory, right? Everybody likes some good butter, right? And what I like to do is butter things up. And I'm not talking about coach and coerce someone, but you add a certain layer of butter for the easier consumption of whatever it is you're trying to convey, you know, to make that butter tastier, to make it easier for the ingestion of whatever data it is. And then from there, the more butter you ingest, the more it sticks to your bones, right? So you butter the data for easier ingestion and to help it stick to the bones. And when I say the bones, I'm really meaning the bones of the brain, understanding that the brain doesn't have bones.
I think that really hurt my brain bone.
I think I heard you through my nose drums.
I agree. I mean, if you ever tried eating popcorn without any butter on it, it's not pleasant.
That is called torture, my friend. That's just a step or so below waterboarding. But anyway, you know, to kind of bring the topic back at hand. So you've written this book. It's a pretty awesome book, if I might say so myself. And I have lots of leather-bound books, and my apartment smells of fresh mahogany. With that being said, though, tell us about the process for writing the book. I know there's some people that listen that want to write a book. Me, personally, I want to write a book as well. I just can't figure out what I want to write about. The good idea fairy comes and visits too frequently.
Tim, do you want to start?
Sure. So I think, you know, first of all, the idea, coming up with the idea is usually not the problem, right? It's We all come across these things that we're dealing with in security, whether it's, you know, a topic like ransomware or a topic like DNS or practical Unix security or whatever it happens to be. If everybody knew this or if everybody understood these concepts, it would help. That's coming up with the ideas is the easy part. It's then part of it is really following through. And that's really, you know, that's really the hardest part of anything, right? Taking the idea and building it into a framework, coming up with an outline that really allows you to show a genuine flow of information, and how you're able to actually convey all of the topics that you want to convey effectively to the audience without alienating any of the audience. Once you've built the outline out, it's then a matter of building, you know, the various research tools that you're going to use, whether it's a very deep technical topic where you're going to be, you know, getting screenshots from things like malware or exploit control panels, or it's a matter of doing the research from a historical perspective if you're looking at something and its change over time. As far as getting to the publishers and everything, Alan is the expert on that, and I'll let him take that piece.
Yeah. So as Tim said, there are a whole lot of ideas out there, and but not all of them will sell enough books to help the publisher cover the cost. So a big part of the process is taking this idea that you have, which Tim and I both had this same experience where we, working for separate companies at the time, were going and talking to customers, and every customer that we went and talked to said, I'm overwhelmed with ransomware. What can I do? And to us, we're thinking, well, wait, how come nobody's really explained to them, come up with kind of a comprehensive solution for, how you deal with the ransomware problem? There were blog posts and different companies had some part of the picture, but there wasn't sort of a comprehensive overview. There's much more out there now than when we started this writing process. And so we sat down, we brainstormed, we put together an outline, put together all of the business justification for why this should be done. And then we got rejected by three publishers. So, we gave it to the first publisher. No, this is not something we're interested in. No, ransomware is too specific of a category. Nobody's going to want to buy it. And then a third one, we never heard back. And then we sent it over to O'Reilly and Courtney Allen, who got back to me within a half hour of submitting it, saying, yes, I love this idea. And of course, O'Reilly being O'Reilly, they are much more, I think, in tune with the security industry than a lot of publishers and with the pain that a lot of the same customers that Tim and I work with are going with. And honestly, you talk about your leather-bound books. My shelf behind me is filled with O'Reilly animals. So, being able to write a book for O'Reilly is a little bit of a dream come true. It's like, it's almost a little nerve-wracking to think, do I have enough knowledge and enough depth of knowledge to deserve that animal? It's somewhat of an intimidating prospect, but when they're enthused about it, that tells me that we're on the right track. And then once they have that outline and the business justification, they send it out to other experts in the field who then yay or nay it. They send the whole outline, the whole justification, and they get back feedback from these other industry experts that say, oh yeah, this is a really good idea. No, this isn't something I'd buy, etc. And I'll never forget one of the experts sent back the feedback. Holy crap! Why didn't I think of this? Because it seemed like in retrospect so obvious to that person that somebody should have written a book on this.
Absolutely, and I want to ask the question: when you were pitching this to publishers and you got rejected, was this before or after, say, mid-2016?
Before mid-2016. So we put together the proposal and the idea probably in February or March, and then started the submission process. And that was about a month, because I would give each publisher about a week to give us a response back before moving on. I don't like the idea of submitting a book idea to multiple publishers at the same time. I'm much more, all right, this is a publisher I think is a good fit. And so I'm going to send it to them. And if they, I'll wait until I hear back from them and then, move on to another publisher. Because there are some publishers that just aren't good fits for certain books.
And you're absolutely correct. And, there are some publishers that are just not good fits for authors, not even the books, just the authors, just to put it into perspective. And, I'm just going to drop a few publishers here. O'Reilly may not be the best publisher for some books, as No Starch Press may not be, as Wiley may not be, as a For Dummies book may not be. And, that's perfectly fine. You've just got to have that persistence. I can't tell you because I've been there. I can only say this because, I'm all about that persistence. And with that being said, if you're going to do something like a book, you need to be persistent. And don't take no for an answer, because when you look at things, a lot of people were told no numerous times before they finally were told yes, and whatever they were trying to achieve came to life. For example, with my current company, I interviewed in July, and I was not selected for the position in August. Someone else was. That's fine. but I kept my options open. And when they came back to me in October looking for someone that's not necessarily a PCI guy, then obviously I was available, and, you know, it didn't work the first time, but I persisted. So, you know, let that be a lesson to you in general, just for life, in and outside of information security. Anything worth doing and worth having is worth fighting for. And sometimes that means you need to submit it numerous times. Would the two of you tend to agree with that?
Absolutely. I think it's not just, you know, the book experience is just one example of how you're going to get turned down. And it's okay. Being told no is an absolutely okay thing, because you often will learn either A, I wasn't a fit for that thing, or B, that my proposal wasn't complete, or it missed some of the areas that I needed to get out there. It was not fully, might not have been fully baked. And so that being able to continuously not only review and investigate that which it is you're trying to do, but also look at the medium in which you're trying to do it, I think are of the utmost importance. And yeah, having a head made of rock is kind of helpful too, because you've got to be able to deal with the fact that, you know, occasionally it will seem like you're beating your head against the wall.
And that's one respect where being a sales engineer, and both of us have experience in that area, is very helpful, because you get rejected a lot, and you deal sometimes in difficult, you know, are forced to deal with difficult situations. So you build up a very thick skull. And, you know, I take solace from the fact that Tom Sawyer was rejected by three publishers before somebody finally said yes to Mark Twain. So, you know, I figure we're in pretty good company.
Absolutely. And look at the number of albums, you know, multi-platinum albums that were rejected on the first run, that, you know, someone from one major label looked at them and said, no, I'm going to pass. You know, you never know. With that being said, we're going to take our first break. And when we come back, we're going to continue the discussion and dive into some innards of ransomware. Stay tuned.
Are you looking for a place to advertise to the unique audience of IT security professionals and enthusiasts? Look no further. Advanced Persistent Security is seeking sponsors. This slot could be yours. Contact sales at advancedpersistentsecurity.net for more information.
I have a few deals that I would like to let you know about. First and foremost, if you want to attend Hacker Halted for free September 13th and 14th in Atlanta, Georgia, please use code HH18JGCON. HH as in Hacker Halted, 18 as in 2018, JG as in Joe Gray, and con as in conference for free admission. A normal ticket value is $199. You can also get 25% off your EC Council training of choice, such as Certified Ethical Hacker, Computer Hacking Forensics Investigator, Certified CISO, and ECSA, EC Council Certified Security Administrator, using coupon code HH18JJTRN. HH18JJTRN. Register at hackerhalted.com. Additionally, if you would like $100 off an EC Council Storm Kit, which is a touchscreen Raspberry Pi kit with a USB mobile keyboard containing Kali Linux, use coupon code JGRAYSTORM at iclass.eccouncil.org. Another project that I'm invested in is called Through the Hacking Glass. It is in conjunction with Brian Austin and Peerlist. For more information, please go to peerlist.com and check out hashtag Through the Hacking Glass or hashtag TTHG. You can email us at tthg@peerlist.com.
And welcome back to the Advanced Persistent Security Podcast. Thank you for sticking around through that break. With me this evening is Alan Liska and Tim Gallo. They are the famed authors of the O'Reilly Skunk Book. The Skunk Book being about ransomware. So we've been talking ransomware. We've been talking about information security success. This episode is the embodiment of the new show slogan of Hallway Con with a topic. So we're going to try to color a little bit within the lines in this portion, but just understand that this discussion is intended to be valuable to you, the listener, as well, without regard to the specific topic. So I'm going to solicit the two of you, and I'm going to turn the floor over to you just to just go on an absolute tangent. Tell us about ransomware. Tell us what you're seeing. You know, give us some information out of the book. Tease us, and then you know, we'll revert back and forth and talk about some of the stuff we talked about during the break as well.
Tim, you want to go first?
I was going to make that suggestion to you, actually, Alan, because I think
that
you should start on this
if
one.
If you're not first, you're last.
So,
Ricky Bobby.
As far as ransomware, it's such a big topic, and there are a lot of different areas in terms of covering ransomware. So we'll start with probably what is the most common question that Tim and I both get asked is, should I pay the ransom if I get popped? I know that's not really the technical part of it, but it is the one that most people ask. And it's an interesting question because it goes back to what we were talking about earlier, and we talk about this in the book, the difference between the technical reality and the business reality. Because Tim and I will both tell you that our first and immediate answer is no, never, ever, ever, ever pay the ransom. You know, if you do that, you're awful. You're contributing to the problem because all that money does is goes to make better ransomware. And there's no guarantee that you'll get your files back even if you do pay the ransom. So just don't do it. But the truth is that from a business perspective, sometimes that's the right answer. And that's a very painful thing to say as a security person. But if there is, if backups don't exist, if you haven't taken the proper security precautions, if in the case of, as we saw with the rash of hospital infections last year, where patient health might be impacted by ransomware, sometimes you may have to pay the ransom in order to continue your business operations continue your business operations uninterrupted. So it is something to think about. And a lot of the things that we talk about when we talk about how you protect yourself from ransomware, most people don't think about until it's too late. So the question of, hey, do I have backups? Most people don't think about it until they're infected. Oh, this machine's infected. Well, do we have backups? I don't know. Or, well, we have a backup program that runs. When's the last time we tested those backups? Well, we don't really test them. We just, it runs and says everything's okay. So I'm sure we're fine. And it's the same thing. At what point do you have to pay the ransomware in order to keep your business operations up and running and not impact things in a meaningful way? So I know that's not sort of a technical introduction, but it is something that's asked very often. And Tim, I'll let you kind of jump off from there.
Yeah, so actually, it's funny. That's one of the things that I like to think about a lot is because of the nature of how you and I and some of the other folks in the industry have gotten here, having worked in IT infrastructure and IT operations prior to getting into security, thinking about those mundane things that are part of every server admin's job, like testing the backups, changing the tapes. Yeah, I'm old. But doing those sort of boring things are part of what we remember having to do and that needed to be done. Sometimes, I think there's a little bit of a little bit of tunnel vision for people that haven't done that kind of work, that just assume that a lot of that happens because that's IT operations and I'm in IT security and we don't play together nicely. When in reality, and I like to think of it this way, Instead of thinking of security as a part of IT, I like to think of IT operations as a part of the overall security function of the business, which at the end of the day, security is strictly an enabler for the business. So thinking about it from that perspective, it puts me into that place where it's like, yeah, no, I remember having to come in on a Saturday morning when I wanted to be, you know, out playing in the dirt, and instead having to change some tapes before I could go catch up with friends because I got an alert that said, the backup failed. It sounds silly, but those are things that I can remember, and those are things that I think we kind of overlook because we get sort of tunnel visioned into the security thing and not think about it as the whole piece. And yeah, we need to understand when we look at it, what is the overall threat to the business operations, and building that sort of risk matrix around it with your business partners is key. If you don't build that understanding and that matrix, then yeah, you get caught into those war rooms where suddenly all of your data is encrypted, and whether you've done, had poor thing, poor professional hygiene with regards to, mapped drives all over the place or not, you've got to make those tough business decisions. And admittedly, from a technical perspective, it's not your call. You're an advisor, but oftentimes that call is made, a layer or two layers above you. And if you're in a regulated industry, then you've got to deal with, okay, well, what's the official regulated definition for a breach, potentially a material breach of, EPHI, for example, in my environment, and how do I have to deal with that? Do I need to call my compliance officers and the privacy officer, and do we have to have a formal incident response associated with this, and how much does that cost us? That's one of those things where I think in many cases, things like ransomware can kind of get underreported simply because people aren't making those calls or looking at it at that level. They're just wiping the system or just paying the bill. And technically, one of the things that we did, I think that's in the book that we talked about is a little bit of the history of ransomware and kind of how it got started. And it's not as much as it's on top of mind and on top of topic for a lot of folks these days. It's not something that's original. It didn't just start out of nowhere. And it's something that's been around for quite a while. And it has morphed and changed. I mean, since the publication, and one of the things that we have, that O'Reilly has done, is given us the ability to sort of, make updates to the book, which I think is really great. I love that from a publisher's perspective, is that the idea of ransomware went from something simple like a system locking capability to, the crypto ransomware, which is doing, a device and file access denial, to now. And this is to me, this is a philosophical debate, but what is the difference ostensibly between extortion that is a criminal, cyber extortion that isn't necessarily tied to a particular piece of malware on your device or in your network, but malware that is being used to control other devices that will deny access to your network from your customers or by your customers? From the strictest definition of the word ransomware, ostensibly that is the same thing. However, in many instances we're talking about ransomware as the malware itself that is infecting end user devices and either denying access to the systems or locking them. But that, to me, I think, as we go broader and think of cybercrime in general and extortion as a form of crime and waxing esoteric, that second function, that the ability to use other devices to deny your access to your data or your systems, not necessarily your devices, also could potentially be seen as a form of ransomware.
And that's why Tim is kind of a big deal, because he thinks in that level of depth.
And I completely agree with you. I've been writing an incident response plan as of late for a client, and with it, I explicitly said, hey, in terms of scenarios, we'll pick the ones out of the NIST risk, or NIST 800-61. But here's a few others that I recommend. And, you know, I picked a few that were specific to their vertical, but one I specifically picked was actually two. One was loss of a downstream cloud provider, which is irrelevant to ransomware specifically, thanks to the Mariah botnet. And the other was ransomware. And when I'm writing out the actions for ransomware, basically what I did was I put in there that the incident manager needs to coordinate with senior management if a predetermined decision has not been made in terms of whether to pay it or not. Because I didn't put this part in the plan. I always think back to Schrodinger's backup, right? So if you think about Schrodinger's cat, it's imagined as being enclosed in a box. This is directly from Google. So it's imagined as being enclosed in a box with a radioactive source and a poison that will be released when the source unpredictably emits radiation. And that cat being considered, according to quantum mechanics, to be simultaneously dead and alive until the box is opened and the cat is observed. Right? So let's apply that to backups for a moment. The condition of any backup is both alive and dead until a restore attempt is made, right? So with ransomware, if you fall victim to it, there's a few considerations that I definitely put into this incident response plan, because do you pay it? Will they follow through on their promise that if you pay it, they'll unlock you? That may be the case. It may not. You may just be out of $5,000 worth of Bitcoin. Do you try to restore from a backup? How long did this software sit on your machine dormantly waiting for some sort of logic or time variant? It could have been sitting there for ages, not really ages, but you know, a significant period of time, to where even if you restored from a backup from 3 weeks ago, for the sake of argument, you still have it. Alternatively, if you try to restore from backup, you may anger the author and they may just delete everything. If your backup is connected to the network and you're not using tapes or offsite backups or cloud backup, guess what? You probably don't have backups. if you allow Dropbox or another cloud provider to automatically sync your files, and you know the ransomware makes its way through that directory, guess what? Those are going to be encrypted as well. As well as everything else in your cloud library, if so configured to do so. So, you know, it is a slippery slope. And, you know, I'm glad you talked a lot about, in principle, you should not pay, but in reality, payment is probably the best route. And it's not the best route for everyone, nor did you say so. But, you know, sometimes it is, sometimes it's not. And that's one of those decisions that management just has to make, because, as you did say, at the end of the day, security is here to support the business. From my opinion, I like to think that as a security professional, I help enable the business to do what they do in an efficient manner and basically keep those types of problems under control so that they can effectively do what they need to do.
That's absolutely correct. Yeah. And that's the, yeah. You know, and that's really important in terms of what, you know, this conversation we keep going back to about how security needs to be part of the business process. So when you're putting together a plan for how you're going to deal with ransomware, you should put together a plan, and you should put that plan together with the different groups that you have to interact with. And that plan should be signed off by senior management so that everybody's in agreement and we all know what's going on. And then be prepared if something bad does happen, that plan may change. And you as a security professional need to be able to adapt to what the situation on the ground currently is.
Absolutely, because no two situations are the same. You can have a written plan, and a written incident response plan that says, you'll do things this way if this situation occurs. Well, sometimes that's not the case. Sometimes that won't work. Sometimes you're going to have to call the proverbial audible with your plan and find another way to solve the problem. And with that, there's nothing wrong with it as long as you properly debrief it in your lessons learned portion of the report, correct?
Yeah, I mean, I like to think about it as you've got a number of playbooks that are part of your, you know, that are modular and part of your overall program, right? And one of those playbooks has to be, and I don't know if any, I'm sure some of your listeners have in the past or currently play Shadowrun, but one of those modules, those playbook modules has to be hack on the fly, right? Which ostensibly is, okay, nothing else here makes sense, and none of the different pieces I have that I can put together are going to fit with this situation. I need to improvise, and I need to deal with, okay, what exactly is in front of me? I've got all of these tools, and I've got these different ways of looking at it, but how can I bring them together to be able to respond effectively to this situation?
And, you know, that's one of those things that if you fail to plan, you plan to fail, really. Okay, so tell us a little bit more about what you've learned through your research for this book.
So I think what is interesting is there are a couple of different types of reasons why ransomware has been so successful. You know, part of it is, of course, because you get the instant gratification, but part of it is the business model behind the ransomware. In that there are a couple of things that have been very effective. So you have a model that plugs ransomware into existing delivery infrastructure, whether that is spam botnets or whether that's exploit kits that have already been around. So essentially, the ransomware authors are making use of existing capabilities to deliver their ransomware. So it's not something new. It's not something that is has to be completely redesigned from the ground up. So they have existing infrastructure, and they're just plugging into that infrastructure. So they're letting the spam bots do their thing and keep improving what they do. They're letting the exploit kits keep improving the way they do. And what they're doing is they're improving their ransomware delivery systems. And it's very interesting to watch the cycles. Before Lockheed went offline in December, not offline, but let's say it's diminished delivery, we were seeing every month a new release of Lockheed, and sometimes multiple times a month. So the developers behind Lockheed are getting feedback from their from their victims in terms of what's working, what isn't working. Not direct feedback. I don't believe they're sending out SurveyMonkey surveys or anything like that. But they're getting they're finding what system works, and they're adapting their program to do that. Now, part of that is because they're getting the money flowing in. They are they have the research and development budget to be able to do that, and it's almost like they're on sprint cycles, right? Where they're making constant improvements to the program, and we see that with Server, and we see that with CryptXX, we see that with these ransomware platforms that have been consistently the top performers in terms of the success rate. One of the reasons that they're so successful is they're constantly evolving how they're doing their delivery, what methods they're using for delivery, and trying to develop new ways to do it. So, as Kevin Mandiant liked to say, it's not a what, it's a who. In this case, what we're seeing is real results of a team of developers who are working on this constantly to improve it. And then the other aspect that I think has been very interesting with ransomware is the phenomenal growth of the ransomware as a service. So if I just want to get started in the world of ransomware and I need some money quickly, but I don't know what I'm doing with malware or anything else, I can go rent some ransomware, and I don't even have to put any money down first, right? No money down. It's, here, you're going to take 40% of the profits and you're going to give me 60% of the profits. All I have to do is have a bunch of email addresses that you can spam.
And that's huge, right? I mean, that's, thinking about this and thinking about this from an economic perspective, at the end of the day, ransomware, unlike other nefarious actors who are doing it for, anything from hacktivist purposes to bring down the system, or for patriotic purposes because they believe in the nation state that they live in. Criminals and extortionists and ransomware authors are all in it for one thing and one thing only, and that is cold hard cash. And if I can find new ways that I can monetize the work that I've done, why wouldn't I repurpose it? Why wouldn't I take the ransomware that I've written, that I've already gotten a lot of my direct money out of, and resell it? Build platforms that allow me to just take in the email addresses and send out the spam and get my cut. It's the Amazon way, right? Not only am I selling a bunch of stuff, but now I've taken the platform that I use to sell all my stuff, and I'm going to find ways to monetize that as well. Doing the same thing. I mean, just seeing some of these kits becoming available for anybody who has the intent to perform nefarious activity, like AK Builder is one that I know that just that's there's been some research, fresh research done on. I think those are things that are just another way for criminals to look to make money. Because at the end of the day, this type of malicious activity is strictly economic. I want to make money. How can I do so? This is the smash and grab. It's the big guy with the baseball bat standing in front of the dry cleaners, saying, "Be a real shame if you lost all your customers," right? That's all this is. And how can I get money easily and take advantage of you know, the fact that there are so many systems out there that can be just owned up?
Absolutely. And I'm so glad that you mentioned exploit kits, because I've got like five things swirling in my mind right now. First and foremost, while I was doing research for one of my most most recent talks, I discovered that there was a ransomware author somewhere in Europe, and this was from the Semantic ITSR. They were only charging about 200 euros per infection, but because of the infection rate, this author was actually making like 30,000 euros a day, and the total came to like 394,000 per month.
That sounds about right.
And through that same talk, not to let too much of the cat out of the bag, but I also did a cross correlation between the ratio of phishing emails and the ratio of emails with malware in it. And when the talk goes public and the slides are there, something you will notice is that some of the data that's there, the correlation is very clear. It definitely shows how easy it is to draw that conclusion that the actual phishing rate is, for the most part, directly proportional to the malware attachment rate. But speaking of exploit kits, I get a lot of emails, a lot of phishing emails, and we talked about some of them during the break. And one of them that I get a lot of claims to be from the Postal Service, and it says something to the effect of, "We attempted to deliver your parcel, but no one was available. Either click here to print your shipping label," which makes no sense, "or alternatively, click here for whatever." And then there's a phone number on some of them. And a pattern I've observed in many of these, the phone number syntax. So in the United States, we typically do either the area code in parentheses, then first three dash last four, or dash dash as opposed to the parentheses, or everything, or even sometimes, very rarely, you might even see plus one and just the number. What I've noticed on these, it's area code dot first three dot last four. Do you think this could be coming from an exploit kit? And, you know, before you answer that, I know that, you know, we were talking about some articles that you had shared in terms of Semantic saying that basically, well, actually, share with us what Semantic and FireEye said, and we'll talk about the conclusion that we potentially drew during the break.
Actually, so it was Kaspersky, it was Kaspersky through ThreatPost. So there was a great article in ThreatPost earlier this week about how they've seen a huge drop in exploit kit related ransomware. They're seeing all of their ransomware originate from, not all, but they're seeing more and more in terms of percentages of their ransomware come through spam. 2 days before that article came out, FireEye published a blog post talking about how they're seeing more ransomware originate from exploit kits. And it's a little bit of a challenge because there have been a lot of exploit kits that have disappeared over the last year and then a few others that have sprung up. So there's been a shift in which exploit kits are the ones that are delivering the most malicious traffic. But it's very interesting from that perspective that from one view, from the Kaspersky view, that is there's actually fewer ransomware as a percentage being delivered through exploit kits. And from the FireEye perspective, there is more ransomware as a percentage being delivered through exploit kits. And I thought you and Tim had some really good ideas on that.
Yeah, I mean, when I think about this, right, and this is one of those, what's your visibility and what's the viewpoint that you're taking when it comes to these things, right? So you take it from one vendor's signals intelligence collection capability and what they're where they're gathering their information. And it's primarily from the network, right? And they're looking at all of this information traveling through their network devices and using that to identify potential ransomware delivery methods and exploit kits and using that as their protection detection scheme, right? So they're going to see, you know, an increase in exploit kits because that's, you know, where as they've more finely tuned their capability at that layer, they're going to be able to be better at protecting against that. Then you go the other side and you're taking a look down at the endpoint and, you know, you've got something saying, you know, oh my God, there's a bear loose in the Colosseum here simply because that's this malware somehow managed to get through my environment, SMTP filters to this endpoint, and it's an email vector that managed to get it in. And so by looking at the endpoint, they're going to see primarily that the primary methodology that they're going to see first is probably that it came in through some form of email, some form of phishing or spam email. And I think it's where the telemetry is coming from that you're looking at these various things. Is going to color your viewpoint, and so extracting yourself from that and looking one step above it, I think is what we have to do is say, well, maybe there is no decrease in either one, but maybe each technology is getting better at detecting it at its various control points. That's just a thought.
And then I think, Joe, you had you had some thoughts because of what you're seeing in the spam email. I think that'd be really good to share with everybody.
Absolutely. So I do maintain an email address that anyone that's listening, if you want to forward your phishing emails to it, it's phishing@advancedpersistentsecurity.net. When you send it, I ask that you forward the email so I can see it in its deliverable context. And if you can, forward it as an attachment or download the attachment and save it as a file and email it. Again, that's phishing@advancedpersistentsecurity.net. But basically, some of the stuff I've seen coming in on that email account that people have been forwarding, and some of the junk emails that come into some of the email addresses that are mentioned on the Advanced Persistent Security website but aren't necessarily used, they're just kind of there, kind of like slinkies. But in that vein, some of the emails I see coming in, you know, like I was talking about with the pattern, it almost made me wonder, are these skiddies going and purchasing exploit kits, and is this part of the exploit kit? You know, I'm seeing an increase of the parcel ones, as I call them, the FedEx, the UPS, the USPS ones. I got one a while back from Delta talking about my trip from, I think, D.C. to Denver, and everything was in... No, it was D.C. to Florida, and everything was in Central Time, and I was like, nope, I'm not in D.C. or Florida, so it doesn't make sense. I've been getting some from, air quote, Amazon, saying that my iPhone 7 is shipping. I recall I got that on February 13th. I felt very playful on February 14th, and I emailed them back. I said, hey, I've not received this iPhone. Please advise. And I didn't hear back. So then like a week later, and this is going to get to the point, about a week later, I get another email from air quotes Amazon, saying that my Dell PowerEdge servers had been purchased and were about to be delivered, purchased at a cost of $1,300 each. I waited a few days and I responded. I was like, hey, I still haven't received these servers. I really need you to advise. That's a lot of money taken from my account. Please advise. I really need to hack some scammers and other criminals. And I didn't hear back from that either. But the moral of the story is I've noticed that a lot of these emails come out very cyclically. And what I mean by that is I might receive one and then every time receive another one almost identical or identical within about 20 minutes. It's almost like they're on a schedule, kind of like scheduled like a cron job or something. And that almost made me wonder about, is this coming from an exploit kit? But in conversating during the break, we also talked about the potential of renting botnets, and that's definitely a distinct possibility as well. But I just find it ironic that these emails are coming almost on a schedule. Part of what I intend on doing when I get a large enough data set from that phishing at Advanced Persistent Security email account is to actually run data sets on the heuristics. Like, obviously, I want to look at, does it have an attachment? Does it have links? What is the attachment? All that fun stuff. But I also want to look at things like, what time of the day are these sent? Are these consistently sent at the same time on the same day of the week? What time zone are they coming from? I want to get that kind of data, like basically the softer metadata on it, because I'm not very solid at reverse engineering malware. I'm not heavy in programming. So I'll leave that to those trained professionals. But what I can do is run analytics and statistics on large data sets. And I would be interested to see what's going on.
Yeah, I think if you take a look at that, perform those types of analyses on those data sets, you'll probably find some consistencies there. And one, as you mentioned, right, notice sort of that you're seeing these come every 20 minutes to an hour. If you get one, you expect the next one. And that really is in my mind, primary indicator that is part of, you know, some bot herder that has rented out their net and is delivering this spam, simply because it would it's trying to find its way through the system. They want to make certain that they're getting past various SPLs at the SMTP servers and or SPFs at the SMTP server, and that they're getting into the system itself. Plus, multiple hits, if it does get in, multiple hits to the end user that they're primarily targeting. We're taking advantage of some social engineering tactics here as well, obviously, when you're using spam, is that multiple emails indicate urgency. Urgency is something that forces you to turn off a little bit of your critical thinking skills. And in doing so, that's going to put you into a position where you're no longer actively critically thinking about something. You're instead looking at this and going, okay, holy crap, I've received two notices from the same email address. This is probably real. I've got to do something about this. Instead of actively taking the time, looking at the links, checking, determining, did I ask for this, did I order this, instead of asking myself those real questions.
Right. Well, and that urgency is, and not on the ransomware topic, but that urgency is the whole idea behind like whaling attacks and those type of attacks where you make it sound urgent enough that you have to respond. And that's a really good point. But I think also going back to the concept of things being cyclical, if you guys remember the black hole exploit kit, which I think is probably 3 years old now, that was a spam exploit kit. We've kind of seen exploit kits delivering spam drop off simply because everybody's been using the Mirai botnet and the other associated botnets in order to do their spam delivery. But there has been there has been a huge increase in spam since the beginning of the year, and so there may very well be, and I'm not aware of it, and I'm not doing that kind of research. But it is entirely possible that there's an exploit kit now out there that is doing the spam and doing the spam on that routine work as well. So, that's definitely one avenue of investigation.
Absolutely. And one thing I want to play into, because, I do a lot of research and talking on social engineering. when you're talking about the urgency and the authority, all of that plays into the six principles of persuasion. You know, Dr. Cialdini's six principles of persuasion, where you have commitment and consistency, reciprocity, urgency, scarcity, social proof, likability, and authority. So a lot of ransomware plays into that. A lot of malware in general plays into that. You know, oh, you must click this and pay this, or the FBI is coming for you. Or, like with Jigsaw, you have 1 hour to pay this, or we are going to dox you. And from what I can tell, it appears as if they follow through with that. So, you know, there's a point where the scareware aspect of it ends and the legitimacy of the social impact of it begin. And I think, you know, when you're employing specifically urgency and specifically authority, you know, I think that's really it. And for the longest, when people were paying and everybody was getting unlocked, that also showed reciprocity. The other three, not so much, but they can play into the delivery in other ways.
Absolutely. And that is, I mean, and that's a big part. I know a lot of people like to poo-poo threat intelligence, but that's because we sort of have this mindset of what threat intelligence is in you know, information security, and it's IP addresses, domains, you know, that's what it is. But it's not. Threat intelligence is more than that. And in particular, when you're talking about ransomware, one of those things that you need to know is, have I been hit with a ransomware that if I go ahead and pay the ransom, my files are going to be unencrypted? Or is this one of those fake ransomwares? You know, that's where the sites like ID Ransomware and No More Ransom and Fight Ransomware that have that information that's, you know, free and publicly available to people, say, you know, you can look at that screenshot or upload a file and say, yeah, you've been hit with this ransomware, and then you can do your homework, you know, going back to having a plan in place, you can do your homework to say, okay, this is a, you know, ransomware that if we're forced to pay the ransom, our files will generally be unencrypted, you know, or, oh no, this is one of those fake ransomware. We know that we don't need to, you know, we know that we don't want to pay this ransom, even if it is mission critical, because we're not getting our files back. So, you know, that a big part in, you know, tying into what you're saying, you know, that knowing what you're hit with is a form of threat intelligence that will give you that information that allows you to make a more intelligent, you know, a more informed decision.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely important, simply because some of them definitely are part of the we're not going to pay the ransom, we're not going to give you your files back if you pay the ransom. But there are others, especially early on when the trend really started to kick up, where they were just poorly coded. So it didn't matter if they were able, you know, if they fully intended to give you your files back or not, but they did not make it possible to do so because they used poor coding practices and key management practices. You know, another resource that I think is good to be able to look this stuff up is the New Jersey cybersecurity site, the NJKIC. They have a list of ransomwares as well that have public decoders or decoders that have, you know, systems have been cracked. So that's another good place to go look.
Absolutely. And to kind of start to wind this segment down, towards the end of your book, you do talk about ransomware targeting medical devices. Tell us a little bit more about that.
So, you know, it's not the medical devices themselves. Let me step back. And what I talk about specifically in the book, and I wrote that section, is for people to understand the difference between science fair projects and real world threats. People want to know, hey, you know, could somebody install ransomware on my pacemaker and, you know, if I don't pay the ransom, they shut it off? In theory, if there's a computer in it, yeah, probably. You know, it's entirely possible. Is that a likely scenario? or is the more likely scenario that somebody is going to infect the Windows box that hasn't been patched in 3 years that is controlling those medical devices? So when we talk about infecting medical devices and in general, ICS systems and IoT and all the other buzzwords that are out there, it's not as likely for ransomware to hit those devices as it is for the Windows controller. So when I'm concerned about ransomware in medical professions, I know that there are a whole lot of unpatched systems running very old operating systems in these hospitals, in these doctor's offices, not necessarily because of negligence on the part of the IT staff and the security staff, but because they're forced to run applications that only run on old unpatched versions of the software, and the vendor hasn't released new versions. Now, should these hospitals and should these medical offices band together and demand better capability from their vendors? Yes, they absolutely should. But because they are leaving themselves potentially exposed to that. So when you talk about ransomware against medical devices, you're talking more about the controllers themselves than the actual devices. At least that's my experience. Tim, you may have different thoughts.
No, today and probably in the near future, that I 100% agree with you. Do I think that could be something that happens, down the road? It depends upon the persistence and the nature of, how malicious the attackers are going to get. I think, before we see, somebody implanting in devices, I see supply chain risk to phones instead, right? That's a lot easier way for me to pre-inject into somebody. And if I can find a way to catch downstream from the phone manufacturer prior to it hitting the distributor or the sales point, that would be an interesting way for me to automatically get ransomware that has a long dwell time, so that once something is fully activated, be able to encrypt somebody's cloud files once they've attached to it. That to me, I think, is probably a shorter term attack than, actively going out and turning off somebody's pacemaker if they don't pay. Now, is that a really cool, super nefarious, awesome, evil genius thing to do? That's a British bad guy driving a Jaguar that turns into an airplane. That's the kind of thing he's going to do. I don't see it happening in the near or even not so distant future.
And to piggyback off what you already said, should the medical industry band together and demand better security? Honestly, I think it's more than just the medical industry. I would actually venture to say that realistically, the general public as a whole should band together and demand this. Because, when you talk about ransomware on a computer or a server, you can buy a new one. You can get a new one. There's something you can do about it. When you're talking about a medical device, this kind of plays into Chris Roberts' talk that he delivered at B-Sides Indy about basically hacking the human body via nanotechnology. But with that being said, you can't really get a new pacemaker, right? You can't get a new heart. You can, but you have to be on a list for a long time and, keep that in mind. But with that being said, though, I think we just need to push it, there has to be some level of rebellion, I guess, for lack of a better term, to push industry into doing it. And, I kind of thought there for a second, the whole MedSec thing, I thought that was actually going to work out. And when I say work out, I mean kind of change industry for the best. But I don't think that's the case. And while I've got two ransomware experts, absolute big deals, that can really shake it and bake it on the show. Do you foresee ransomware ever making its way to cars?
Yeah. So, so I guess let me ask you a question. If you get ransomware in your car, are you just going to put the pin in the little reset button and reset the computer and then re-download your settings? You know, it's not like taking over control of a car through malware or anything like that. If my nav system suddenly has ransomware on it and I can just quickly reset the button, you know, hit the reset button, and okay, maybe I have to reprogram my stations if there's anybody out there that still listens to the radio, or I have to reconnect in my Bluetooth to it. There's not that much pain in me losing the data that's on there. So again, yes, absolutely, you could probably write ransomware for a car and have it be effective and so on, assuming you can find a proper delivery method. But what is the likelihood of being paid? So if I'm a bad guy and I say I want to write ransomware for a car, and I figure out a delivery method of somehow, I, you know, hack OnStar satellites and I can, you know, redirect my ransomware down to cars through OnStar, what am I going to get paid for that? That's very different than, oh, I'm a security researcher, here's my ransomware for car, let me present it, Black Hat, yay, I win. That is a that could absolutely be done. But if I'm doing this as a business, if I'm trying to make a living off of this, I don't see the value in that. I don't see where I make money.
See, so there's a couple things I see, and I think it's the money piece that becomes the stopper there, right? Because ostensibly, if I can find, you know, an easy vector, at the, you know, these days is leveraging the Bluetooth connection to the media bus and then finding a way to access the CAN bus on those systems, right? Once you've got access to that, you're able to potentially get into other components of the vehicle itself. But it's that payment piece. You have to know that the vehicle is moving in order to ransom it, or is completely locked, right? It's one or the other. I'm either going to try to ransom the vehicle while it's in motion, and then use audio connections to get the money. Have somebody, you know, be forced to call their bank to make a transaction or something along those lines, or lock up the device while it's parked and make it so that you cannot get into it. So then you've got to be grabbing all that signals, all those signals from the device, from the vehicle itself when it's not moving, or you're using secondary telemetry from the device that was connected to the vehicle that delivered the ransomware in the first place. It gets overly complicated in order to get the funding to get the funding as of the bad guy, right? To get the money. Now, if my target wasn't, you know, Alan or Joe, if my target was General Motors or, you know, Toyota, that's a different story. And I think that's where you're taking it from my target being the consumer to my target being the creator, right? I think it was either yesterday or today, there was some announcements about some hackers saying that they were going to lock up and encrypt everybody's not everybody, but a lot of stuff that's sitting in iCloud, and they were conversing directly with Apple. That to me is the alternative method of payment, and instead of looking for those smaller payouts, going for the big payout at the creator of the technology. And so that's again that's robbing a liquor store versus breaking into the Bellagio vault.
Right. Well, and yeah, and I think supply chain is a very interesting threat. So if I can go to General Motors and say, you know, all of the cars from this particular plant that have this particular system in them, I can activate that so that they shut down immediately, and I'm going to send out a mass notification here unless you pay me X amount of money.
And ostensibly, that's, you know, again, that gets back into the esoteric discussion. Is this type of extortion, even though it's not what we're calling ransomware traditionally, is this type of extortion ostensibly ransomware?
Right. And where I was thinking about this was from the scope of instead of actually encrypting your files on the car, I was thinking of it more basically disabling the car from from being able to function as desired, right? So basically, this ransomware would infect your car, make its way to the appropriate location, and then at that point, it would prevent the car from starting or moving or whatever, right? That's kind of where I was thinking about it. I was less about like what data is stored, like GPS data or any of that. Because, you know, in that context, when you think about it at the high level, with a computer or a server or even, you know, not a refrigerator, but maybe a TV, you can get a new one fairly easily. With a car, you know, the only way to get it would be there would be three ways. Pay, have someone from the dealership or someone bring out new firmware to flash your car with, or have it towed to the dealership to do that.
Yeah, and it's kind of interesting. Alan and I were at a talk at B-Side Nova, and the amount of systems that, you know, the computing systems that exist in modern vehicles are so manifold. And it's nigh impossible to find documentation unless you work for a dealership about where every single piece of compute exists in a vehicle. So the ability to obtain persistence, either in supply chain or, you know, by leveraging, you know, say your device as a pass through to that, becomes almost trivial if you know how to work your way through the vehicle networks. Through the infotainment network into the actual vehicle network itself. And that information never goes, you know, it doesn't go away. There's no, at least, you know, what, from a forensics perspective, from what I understand, and this is, I'm not an expert, I am not an expert in this, but what I understand and what I'd heard was that information there's no like magic reset button for some of that stuff. So all you've got is, replacing it or hard flashing it, and somebody has to have that shop manual to know where every piece of compute is, and if it's even flashable. And if it's not, then you've got to replace all of those little ECUs, and that's costly too. That could be, you know, after that talk, I decided I'm never selling a car without buying brand new ECUs from eBay. Just because all of that information potentially exists on those devices. Now, that's obviously overly paranoid, and that's probably not the truth, but it is just interesting to think about.
Yeah, so it's interesting because we're talking about potentially a cottage industry here, the way that the cottage industry sprung up around stores that replace your cracked iPhone screen. You could have a cottage industry around stores that restore your locked, if we're talking about locker ransomware in this case, your locked car, and get it back up and running again.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's one of those things that's scary. I think it's going to happen at some point. And, you know, honestly, for a vector, a very easy vector would be infect a smartphone and wait for it to connect to the car via Bluetooth and then work its way through the entertainment system.
Yeah.
So on that note, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we will get our parting pieces of advice and say goodbye. Stay tuned.
Are you subscribed to this podcast? If not, please do so on iTunes and at advancedpersistentsecurity.net/podcast.
Welcome back to the Advanced Persistent Security Podcast. With me this evening is Alan Liska and Tim Gallo. They would like you to know that on this podcast, everybody loves everybody. With that being said, all great things must come to an end. And with that being said, we're going to have to say goodbye. And I'm going to turn the floor over to Alan and Tim to shamelessly plug any and everything they want. I've specifically directed them to plug their book. They'll tell us how to contact them in the ways they want to be contacted. And then from there, we'll get some parting advice out of them. So, gentlemen, the floor is yours.
The book is available at Amazon, available on the O'Reilly website, probably not at major booksellers, but you can easily find it online. And it's, as Joe said, Ransomware Defending Against Digital Extortion, This is Alan. If you want to get a hold of me, my Twitter handle is UUAlan, and you can always email me at alan@alan.org. You know, any questions and so on, I'm happy to help. My big plug is Tim and I are hosting the first B-Sides in France. It's going to be in Bordeaux in October. I'm hoping to get the call for papers out sometime in the next couple of weeks. So we really would like to see a lot of representation out there to make this a success. And, you know, we'll definitely plug that we do need sponsors. So if you're looking to expand your market in France, or if you're in France and need to grow your security business, you can come and you can come and advertise to a bunch of security professionals in Bordeaux and drink wine. As far as a piece of advice, I'll tell you the same thing that I tell everybody. Never ever click on any links. Just assume that they're all bad. I know that's not useful advice and not practical advice, but it is safe advice. If you never click on anything, you're not going to be exploited by ransomware through an exploit kit.
So, as Alan mentioned, the book Ransomware: Defending Against Digital Extortion, it's available on Amazon. It's available on Riley's site. I'm sure if you take a look through other online e-tailers, you would be able to find that book as well. You can also just do a quick search for my name, because unlike Alan, I've only got this one under my belt so far. So if you look for author Timothy Gallo, that'll be the first of many, hopefully, but it'll be the first one that you'll find. Additionally, as Alan mentioned, we are going to be hosting, we're both on the board for the B-Sides Bordeaux. I'm actually currently working on the badges for that project. It's looking forward to that one, as well as a couple things that I'm working on, and I'm going to shamelessly plug for this upcoming DEF CON. One of the competitions that I am always involved in some way, shape, or form is the beverage cooling competition, and I'm looking forward to this year's. It's going to be a doozy, and I highly recommend coming outside to take a view of that one if you're going to be at DEF CON this year. As far as how to get in touch with me, you can follow me on Twitter at Tim J. Gallo. You can reach me at timothy.j.gallo@gmail.com. That's an easy email address to find me at. Or you can hit me on LinkedIn at LinkedIn, Tim J. Gallo on LinkedIn. When I think about how, the types of things that I would recommend to a noob or somebody getting involved in, taking the first steps in the industry, one of the things is put yourself out there and try, because there's a benefit to losing. You'll get to learn from your mistakes. So try things and fail, and it's okay, because you're going to learn something. To the seasoned professional, don't be afraid to step outside your comfort zone. Lord knows I do all the time. Whether it's learning new coding, trying to learn to code again after 20 years, or figuring out how to take apart a car. These are all skills that may or may not have use, but they're really great mind tricks to get you out of your head in the thing that you're doing all the time, and they make you better at that thing that you're doing all the time for fun and for work.
Most excellent. And aside from BZ's Bordeaux, do you have any other speaking engagements lined up at this time? Where can people find you? At events that you're attending?
For me, not right now. I'm getting married in a few weeks, and that has been kind of consuming all of my time. Anything that I do wind up speaking at, I definitely brag about it on Twitter, because I'm always excited to and frankly honored every time somebody thinks that what I have to say is worth saying. So definitely follow me there, and I'll keep it up. And speaking of that, I think for both Tim and I, Joe, we really appreciate you letting us talk today, and appreciate your podcast in general. I know we both have listened to it for a long time and really both learn a lot from it.
Thank you very much. This is one of those things that I
I do it because I love doing it, and I do it because I learn a lot from it. I meet a lot of awesome and interesting people like yourselves, and I appreciate you taking the time out of your day to come onto the show and, you know, sit and chat for a while and, you know, share some ideas and, you know, hopefully provide some valuable, insightful data to the listeners. And, you know, I think everyone involved will benefit from it, you, myself, and the listeners. So with that being said, you can follow me on Twitter at @C_3PJoe. The podcast and the blog is at @ADVPersistSec. If you have any feedback for the show, you can email podcast@advancedpersistentsecurity.net. Show us some love via a positive comment if you so feel as such. Like us, love us, give us a review, whatever you'd like, because this podcast is available on all fine podcasting platforms. Until next time, stay secure.
Thank you for listening to the Advanced Persistent Security Podcast. Until next time, stay secure, and don't forget to subscribe to this podcast.